From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump on Friday afternoon capitulated in the battle over a government shutdown that has stretched out to more than a month. In a speech on the White House lawn, Trump agreed to back a deal to temporarily fund the government through mid-March and buy time for further discussions on a border wall.
I am very proud to announce today that we have reached a deal to end the shutdown and reopen the federal government. As everyone knows, I have a very powerful alternative, but I didn't want to use it at this time. Hopefully, it will be unnecessary. I want to thank all of the incredible federal workers and their amazing families who have shown such extraordinary devotion in the face of this recent hardship. You are fantastic people. You are incredible patriots. Many of you have suffered far greater than anyone but your families would know or understand. And not only did you not complain, but in many cases you encouraged me to keep going because you care so much about our country and about its border security.
And that's Trump on Friday announcing an end to the record-breaking shutdown that had impacted 800,000 federal workers, many of whom had marched, rallied, conducted sit-ins, gotten arrested, and threatened to strike over the ongoing withholding of their paychecks. Meanwhile, presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren has introduced a simple new tax plan designed to target the wealth of the ultra-rich. As the shutdown has illustrated, there is a widening gap between the richest Americans and the rest of us that is deeply felt. We turn now to Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. He's written a number of books, including 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to the program, Chuck.
Good to be with you.
So we have a situation now where President Trump, after more than a month of a very debilitating partial federal government shutdown, has finally capitulated and agreed to what sounds like essentially what Democrats were asking him to do a month ago, which is temporarily, fund the government, those parts of it that aren't to do with border security, and buy ourselves some time to actually discuss these details. Is this a big loss for Trump politically?
I think so. I mean, he basically caused this enormous self-inflicted wound on his own political career, but on the country, on hundreds of thousands of working people. I mean, even today, they were starting to do airline stops on the Northeast Corridor flights. I mean, it was getting to a point where it was absolutely ridiculous. So I think it's I think he's lost an enormous amount of credibility and leverage in this situation. He has no credibility, really.
In the clip that we played, he talked about thanking federal workers for, their sacrifice and for showing up to work without complaining, except, of course, that federal workers were complaining loudly. They held sit-ins just, a few days ago at Mitch McConnell's office. Leaders of federal employee unions were arrested. Wrote strongly worded letters, right? I mean, the federal aviation workers, the flight attendants union were saying that their job was at risk because of this shutdown. So they were screaming as loudly as they could to end this shutdown, which Trump never seemed to acknowledge.
Yeah, I don't know where he was getting his news, but clearly, I mean, even just the statement of the flight attendants union, the job actions essentially in workplaces all around the country. I mean, it's true, people showed up for work and tried to do their jobs, but it was not silently. People were speaking out about the impact personally that they were experiencing.
And Trump has been attempting to make this case to Americans that our tax dollars should go toward funding this border wall because crime and violence is pouring across the border. He sort of said, I could have used an emergency declaration, but I chose not to. And he has been over and over again attempting to make this case. A complete turnaround from the time when he had said that Mexico would pay for this wall. And I'm wondering if you think that Americans, ordinary Americans, at a time when they're struggling financially, are really buying these lies about billions of our tax dollars going toward this wall.
Well, clearly there's a segment of his supporters who believe it, but he's not even sort of making the case for a wall on its own merits. I mean, even if you believe his assumptions, which are false about crime and inflow and drugs, et cetera, a wall isn't going to, address the underlying concerns he's been talking about. I think more and more people are just waking up to, every elected representative, Republican and Democrat, along the border oppose the wall. That should maybe tell us something about, the people who are on the border, their view on the fallacy of the wall. Mm-hmm. One thing I do think that this the shutdown exposed was just how many people live paycheck to paycheck, not just federal workers, but, it lifted up that experience of, the number of people who live underwater or close to the edge financially.
One paycheck away from complete crisis. Right, and I'm wondering what your opinion is of some of the statements coming out of the White House and his cabinet members. I mean, Trump himself sort of alluded to, grocery stores know or neighborhoods know who federal workers are when they're going out to buy groceries, implying that somehow, stores were giving out free groceries or neighbors were buying each other free groceries as a way to get through the shutdown. Then you had Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross saying that people should just take out loans, if they have trouble making ends meet. How cut off is the Trump administration and its members from the reality of everyday Americans?
Well, clearly they're really clueless. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's statements reflect some. He's one of the wealthiest people in the country, and he's lecturing workers on going out and getting, temporary loans that can be secured by their future government paychecks. Doesn't really understand how most people live. I mean, one out of five households in this country has zero or negative wealth, and they probably don't have access to credit. And how much can people borrow against credit cards and other forms of debt? I mean, that's they're a very debt-oriented group. They're promoting student debt, consumer debt, every other kind of debt. So maybe that's why they're like, yeah, more debt.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's a reflection of their utter cluelessness.
And we imagine that a federal government employee might have a solidly middle-class job. And perhaps once upon a time, that might have been true. But as this government shutdown exposed, federal workers are clearly underpaid. State workers, looking at our Los Angeles teachers' strike, many making personal sacrifices, struggling to make ends meet, trying to figure out, if that strike had gone on for much longer, how they were going to live. Overall, we have a situation where even though the stock market is booming, ordinary Americans are struggling, which brings us to Elizabeth Warren's tax plan. We've heard of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's marginal tax rate plan of 70%, taxing corporations at 70%. And then Elizabeth Warren came out with this very simple, very elegant tax plan to tax what would amount to, I understand, only 75,000 Americans. This is something that would impact just a small number of Americans. What has she proposed?
Senator Warren's proposal is a wealth tax. And an annual wealth tax, which is very different than, say, like an estate tax, which is, the tax at the end of life, a transfer tax, or an annual income tax, or even increasing the marginal rate. A wealth tax really focused on the wealth of the ultra-millionaire, billionaire class. So her proposal is starting at 50 million. So any of your listeners who have less than 50 million would not be affected by this tax.
So don't worry if you don't have $50 million.
That would be an annual tax of 2% on wealth starting at 50 million and a 3% tax on wealth over $1 billion. So it's, as you say, it's only going to affect about 75,000 households. That's less than one out of every 1,000. It's the tippy top, the most wealthy people in the United States. But it would raise substantial money. It would raise some, $2.75 trillion of revenue over the next 10 years. And somebody like Jeff Bezos would, who has $137 billion, would pay an annual tax of $4.1 billion for that first year. But he would be obviously the person who paid the highest rate. But just to give you a sense, it's very progressive, and it's in some ways the perfect proposal for our time, because we're living in this time of such extreme wealth inequality that an annual income tax, even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's proposal, we should raise the annual income tax, but a wealth tax really gets at the deeper inequality rift that's happening in our country.
So do you think that this sort of tax would be tremendously well received among the public at this particular political moment?
Well, we know that taxation of the wealthy, restoring and bringing back progressive tax proposals, is wildly popular. 75% of the population wants to see the top income tax rates go up. I think it's a populist moment, similar to AOC's proposal around the 70% bracket on high income taxes. This will capture a lot of people's imagination. It will change the conversation. There's going to be a lot of attacks and complaints about it. But if people understand, the level of inequality we're living with, I mean, we have now a situation where, the 400 richest people in the United States have as much wealth combined as the bottom 64% of the population. If they understand who's going to pay this tax, how much revenue it's going to raise, and its positive economic impact. And by the way, it's not just about money. It's about defending our democracy against the corruption and corrosion that comes from so much concentrated wealth and power. And I think if we talk about it both as a way to raise revenue, but also a way to save the functioning democratic institutions such as they exist still, that is another really good reason to protect our democracy.
So there's a link between raising tax revenues and the government shutdown that's even more than what we've discussed so far. There was an interesting op-ed in the Guardian newspaper by a federal worker, an anonymous federal worker, on Thursday that cited how another anonymous government staffer had written an article in the right-wing website Daily Caller saying and implying strongly that the government shutdown was good for reducing the size of government. The standard right-wing demand that we need smaller government, meaning we just need government to do less for ordinary people. Trump had retweeted that Daily Caller article, and this anonymous federal employee in the Guardian newspaper described how this was really the end goal. If we basically peeled off government workers, if we reduced the sizes of these government-funded agencies, we wouldn't need to talk about taxing the rich because we wouldn't need those revenues in the first place, right?
Yeah, no, there's no doubt there is a segment of the U.S. right wing who likes this government shutdown, enjoys that, sort of enjoys, making fun of public workers, public servants, focusing on a shrink the government, starve the beast agenda. But that is not a majority view at all. In fact, one of the positive things I think about that came out of the shutdown was putting a human face on all these public servants at the local level in communities, your neighbors, people showing up at soup kitchens, other people like you living close to the edge. So I think in some ways it was a good reminder of what our tax dollars do.
And
I think it's an opportunity. Yeah.
These are people who are protecting our environment, protecting our air, safety. The government employees are tasked with, keeping our national parks clean. Here in Southern California, Joshua Tree National Park has been closed to the public because during the shutdown it was destroyed by, vandals. And that, this is the government workers who help preserve all of this for us. So, So we have this interesting progressive tax that Warren has proposed. And it's interesting because the amount of money projected to be raised through a tax like this is greater than the amount that the federal government loses from the tax reform law that the Republicans passed, right? Aren't we slated to lose $2 trillion over 10 years, whereas Warren's proposal would raise $2.75 trillion over 10 years?
Yes. We should see it as a complement to restoring the progressive income tax, making sure corporations pay their fair share, cutting down offshore tax havens. But to me, annual wealth tax on the super, super rich should be the cornerstone of a progressive tax agenda. It really gets at the wealth. And one thing I like about Senator Warren is she says, look, a lot of people are going to try to avoid this tax. We know that the wealthy move their money around the planet. They have wealth managers who help them hide their money. So she has built into this tax proposal more resources for oversight of the IRS oversight, more resources to audit the 75,000 households that are going to be trying to play games with their wealth, and also penalties for taking money offshore or renouncing your citizenship to avoid taxes. These are all things that have to be put in place alongside any kind of progressive wealth tax.
So how popular do you think this will be in Congress? So we know that it's popular among the public. There have been strong support for AOC's 70% income tax rate, and I'm sure we'll see polls on Warren's proposal showing similar results. But you have members of Congress that are not very economically representative of the public at large. Millionaires are overrepresented in Congress, aren't they? And even among Democrats, you might see reticence to back such a very popular tax.
Well, I think part of how change happened is, I mean, we haven't really had for decades a meaningful discussion about how to address inequality so I think this proposal, you know, we have a political system that's captured by the billionaire class. Putting a proposal out, this allows members to hear from their constituents. It allows for that pressure from below, which is just going to keep pushing up to fundamentally address these inequalities. So even though people didn't run for office pledging to commit to a wealth tax, I think we're going to start to see many, many more people running for office saying, of course we should do this. And this is how I think the political, you know, realignment is going to happen, the shift that's going to happen. So already I think the encouraging signs around, you know, I think the Congressional Progressive Caucus, you know, almost 100 members now are going to lead the charge, making this one of their cornerstones. It's going to completely change the conversation politically, I think.
And we might start to see that this can be a bipartisan issue, at least among the public, right? I mean, we might start to see Republican support in just communities around the country who are tired of the rich, you know, getting away with it all. I mean, Trump came to power making these false promises and using populist rhetoric to speak to white working class Americans who are pretty clearly being screwed over, as the rest of us are, by Trump's policies. And it's, you know, it's been 2 years. They might be able to see through that, one hopes, by now.
No, I think this has is a progressive populist, a beautiful idea. You know, as I said to you, anybody with less than $50 million is not going to be affected by this proposal. Most people know how corrupted our system has become because of big money. And not just, we're talking about people with $100 million, $1 billion, a couple of thousand families that now have disproportionate power and clout and are corrupting everything in our society, media, sports, culture, music, politics. People understand that on a gut level. And I think that it has the potential, as you say, to win over a huge majority of people of all political traditions, because we all see how the billionaire political dominated political system has worked. It hasn't worked for most people.
Well, Chuck, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out more about the work that you do on inequality and financial policies.
Yeah, just you can go to inequality.org. And actually, I have a web piece up about the conception of this idea. There was a meeting with Senator Elizabeth Warren and French economist Thomas Piketty that took place a couple years. I was at the meeting and I took a picture of the two of them autographing books for each other. Huh. So you can read this commentary about what I call the intellectual conception, moment of conception for this wealth tax idea.
And we'll link to that from our website as well. Thank you so much, as always, Chuck, for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Chuck Collins, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. He's written a number of books, including 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, as well as Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. We've been discussing the end of the temporary end, I should say, of the government shutdown, as well as Elizabeth Warren's new tax plan. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.